You are tuned in to a fireside chat with Zany Mystic. Join us now on another exciting metaphysical journey. Relax, tune in, drop out, and take a seat by the fire as we explore new realms and possibilities. This is Magenta Pixie. You can find me at magentapixie.weebly.com. But now, here is Zany Mystic and guest. Enjoy the show.
Greetings, and welcome to a fireside chat with Zany Mystic. I'm your host, Lance White. Tonight, my guest is Mark McCandlish. Mark is an internationally recognized artist who has specialized in aviation and conceptual art within the defense and aerospace industries for the last 30 years. In 1966, Mark experienced an event that would change his life. His first UFO sighting occurred at Westover Air Force Base, where he observed the craft through an 80-power telescope for about 10 minutes before it accelerated out of sight at extreme velocity. He later discovered that this craft had been hovering above a flight of nuclear-armed Boeing B-52s. Mark has spent most of his life trying to discover the science that would make such incredible performance possible, and he believes that there is a plausible answer to interstellar flight without violating the currently accepted laws of physics. Having had dozens of sightings since 1966, he feels certain that this carefully protected technology has been co-opted by an as-yet-unknown group, and the sequestration of this technology has provided that organization tremendous leverage in world politics, finance, and international conflicts over the past five decades. You can find out more on his website, www.markmccandlish.com. So let's welcome Mark to the show now. Hi, Mark. How are you?
Hi, Lance. Great to be with you.
Oh, it was so nice of Cara St. Louis to recommend you for the show. I just love her work, too, and she's one of my favorite guests.
Well, thank you. Yeah, she's very sweet. I helped her with a book that she wrote about chemtrails, a sort of a fictional approach to dealing with a very real kind of problem that's being seen across the face of the planet these days.
Right, right. It seems like people have to revert to fiction to get the truth out there. And another one of my friends, Barbara Hand Clough, just wrote her first book or two of fiction on the Catholic Church. So let's not deviate off onto that branch. But I'm really interested in your comments about free energy and the secret space program and the breakaway civilization. I'd be very curious, and I know the listeners will be too, about your research into that and what are your thoughts. Many people talk about this, so it's not exactly hidden information. It's all over the Internet.
Well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, I began hearing about free energy back in the late 70s, early 1980s, and I always thought that that there might be something to it. I wasn't really sure until I began a correspondence with a retired Army Colonel Thomas Bearden, who's been talking about scalar, psychotronic, and zero-point energy for quite some time. His original briefing on this, I think it was called the Excalibur Briefing, turned into a book, which I read and began looking into this. And he was very kind when we finally established contact on the phone. He spent an awful lot of time sort of bringing me up to speed as someone who has enjoyed science and technology and has been around that kind of an environment for a long time. Used to work on fighter planes in the Air Force when I was in the military service. And so the technology fascinated me. I, however, could not do any of the equations to save my life with all the Greek symbols and everything else. But what I would do is when I would find some of these papers that would be published in journals like Physics Review and that sort of thing, I would read the paragraphs between the equations that explained what the mathematics was supposed to be validating. And that was how I began to become acquainted with some of the science that was behind all this. And probably the premier area of what you might call free energy research has to do with something called quantum zero-point fluctuations of the vacuum. And this is really an electrical charge, a flux, if you will, that's embedded in the fabric of space-time itself. And it turns out that over the years, people like My friend Dr. Hal Puthoff, who's down in Austin, Texas, wrote a number of papers that described how the very effect of mass and inertia, both of these things, are basically the end result of the interaction between this energy form, the zero-point energy, as it's sometimes colloquially called, mm-hmm. And its interaction with the atomic structure of matter. In fact, you know, when I was a kid studying physics in high school, one of the things that I could never understand was why matter itself did not seem to obey the second law of thermodynamics, which is entropy. In other words, the frictional or the different losses that you would expect with the subatomic particles of the atom, the electrons, the neutrons, the protons, they never slow down. They're always moving all the time. It sort of is a derivative of the whole thing about how energy can never be, or I should say matter could never be created nor could never be created or destroyed, but it can
right.
be converted into energy. And so as it happens, I mean, that was the whole the idea behind Einstein's equation, E equals MC squared, the basis for the atomic bomb, splitting the atom and releasing this tremendous amount of energy in chain reactions. But it turns out that the very thing that's keeping the structure of the atom intact, the very thing that keeps all of those particles in motion all the time, is this interaction with zero-point energy. In fact, when Einstein, back 100 years ago, it's hard to believe it's that long ago, but 100 years ago, was talking about his theory of general relativity and how, you know, according to his calculations, that it would never be possible to accelerate through space-time up to and beyond the speed of light, because as you begin accelerating through space-time, your mass would begin to increase. It was an effect of moving through space-time, accelerating. And that, in fact, as you begin to approach the speed of light, that your mass would literally be approaching infinity. So you could never possibly carry enough fuel with you to exceed that velocity. And then there were all sort of kinds of other effects, the pace of time and things like that would begin to change in dramatic ways also. Well, it turns out that that entire limitation of not being able to be able to go beyond the speed of light really was locked in the definition of what is mass. Mm-hmm. And mass is an effect. It's a variable effect. This is something that a lot of people are not familiar with, is that it changes with the movement of the structure of whatever happens to be in motion. In other words, if it's a person or a car or a spaceship or a jet airplane, this is what causes the effect of G-forces. It's the inertia, the byproduct of having mass, and the faster you move through space-time, the greater your mass is. And it's basically, think of it as being like riding your bicycle in a rain storm where it's sprinkling lightly, and you have this sort of even distribution of rain droplets in the environment. So if you move through this environment at a fairly slow velocity, the pace at which your clothing becomes soaked with water and becomes heavier, in other words, sort of as an analogy to gaining mass, it only happens up to a certain point. But if you move through the environment very quickly, your interaction with the rain droplets increases dramatically, so you become soaked and very heavy. Your clothes sort of weigh you down and slow you down. And so if you think of it in those terms, if you say, for example, had a big funnel sticking out in front of your bicycle that could gather up all the raindrops and would funnel the water down into a steam engine, you wouldn't get wet, you wouldn't become heavier, but you'd have all those water droplets available to drive your bicycle forward at a much higher speed. And so that's kind of what the underlying plan or proposal would be for being able to sort of do a workaround on exceeding the speed of light. You find a way to capture all of this zero-point energy that's in the environment that would ordinarily be interacting with your vessel as you accelerate through space-time. You gather the zero-point energy out of the environment, and you use this to do the work of propelling the craft forward. So literally, as you go faster, you have greater and greater quantities of this zero-point energy that you can tap into and use for additional propulsive force. And that's really kind of the concept that developed into the first superluminal or faster than light speed engines or propulsion systems, because they really aren't mechanical engines in the traditional sense. They're more like giant Tesla coils with huge capacitor arrays. And they also use, chambers that allow a kind of, almost like a type of plasma physics to be exploited. And when you combine all these things in a certain way with the overlapping electrostatic and electromagnetic fields, you can wind up creating a method by which you can tap into the zero-point energy and actually use it to the point where it is so concentrated in the capacitor section of your vehicle that it actually begins to warp space and time. And that's really the basis for these systems being able to work as effectively as they do.
Now, did Tom mention that these things are already in existence?
Tom Bearden?
Yeah.
He will not state publicly that he told me that, but I do remember a conversation with him back in the late 1980s saying that one of the reasons he felt that the manned space program for NASA had been cut back so severely after we went to the moon was because that there was another program, and I think he was sort of hinting at the secret space program, and he indicated that there were technologies in deployment even then that had taken man all around the solar system. And that they saw no need to continue investing billions of dollars into primitive rocket engines that take forever to get somewhere.
Well, right. You know, John Lear talks about that also on Facebook and in his lectures and things. And he takes it even a few steps further than that, that NASA was set up and created as a front by the powers that control the world that you mentioned, those that we don't know.
Sure.
And that the one of the Nazi scientists was the head of NASA for many years, and that was a disinformation group to fool the nation into thinking that was where we were at, while secretly the corporations, and we don't need to mention any names, they're all known, were working with those who had done extremely advanced research, like the Nazi scientists in Germany, to bring this technology forward and develop it privately. And, of course, you've got Area 51. You know, there are hundreds of underground military bases that we have no idea what they're doing. And from what most people have said, there is a breakaway civilization that could literally leave. And Jay Widener said they've already left. But there's no way that we could know because we don't have access to that information. So...
yeah, all of that is true, and I've certainly seen lots of evidence to authenticate that. I live in Northern California in a kind of a small town, 150,000 people, called Redding, and it's sort of...
neighbors.
I wasn't aware of that, but this part of the state... I've had so many UFO sightings up here in the last 20 years, far more than I ever had when I was in Southern California, where there were so many more aerospace and defense contractors. Even spending time, up on the mountaintops, looking at the high desert and sort of overlooking the area where Edwards Air Force Base and the China Lake Naval Weapons Station are located, where there's a lot of underground activity going on. Never saw the degree or the frequency of activity that I've seen up here. And in fact, the thing that I've noticed, as someone who enjoys astronomy and enjoys looking at the stars through telescopes and things like that, I spend a lot of time under the stars. And so, if you just keep your eyes open, chances are you begin to distinguish things like satellites and meteors from other kinds of things moving through the environment very quickly that obviously are, changing direction, so they're not meteors, and they're moving way too fast to be airplanes or satellites. And of course, much closer. And some of these things, I've seen some monstrously huge craft Within just a week or two of 9/11, back in 2001, I was out watering some plants late in the evening, and I heard something that can only be described as a vehicle moving very fast over gravel. The tire is sort of an electrical crackling sound, but it sounds an awful lot like tires rolling over gravel at high speed. But I turned around expecting that someone was coming up my driveway, and caught a glimpse of a very large cigar-shaped vehicle moving from east to west in a descending trajectory. And this thing was at least as large as an aircraft carrier, probably maybe 2 to 3 times that size. It basically had the sort of a heavier girth towards its front end, rounded it both the front and the back, moving it at just an absolute breakneck pace with a very long ionization trail behind it. And as it descended into the coastal mountain range that was to the west of where I was standing, it suddenly vanished. But the thing that was most startling of all was that the entire ionization trail, which sort of diminishes and gradually disappears at about the same pace as the object is moving across the sky, but, you know, there's a little bit of a delay because the thing is, you know, stretching, you know, a third of the way across the sky, but the entire ionization trail vanished at the same moment, which seems like someone's obviously been manipulating time in order to have something like that happen visually. Mm-hmm. Now, I've experienced time dilation. It's one of the sort of little sidebar investigations to looking at some of the advanced technology propulsion systems that I sort of inadvertently discovered through contacts in the defense and aerospace industries. I began looking at other things like the so-called alien abduction phenomenon, and I was a complete skeptic. You know, I thought that this was really sort of a population of people that were starved for attention and had psychological problems. And I studied psychology and spent some time working in the mental health field for a while. So I felt that I could sort of recognize some of the characteristic behaviors of people that had problems. And what I really found were people that were exhibiting clear manifestations of post-traumatic stress syndrome. People, in many cases, that were highly intelligent, very articulate, who had X-rays and MRIs that could show very clearly that they had foreign objects not only in different parts of their body, but in their brains, behind their eardrums.
Oh, yeah.
And the scars that revealed exactly where these things were put into their body, generally penetrating right through the skin. In one case, this young lady had two, which it looked like small bullet holes in the roof of her mouth.
Oh my!
And yeah, I mean, it gave me chills when she says, "You want to see where they put them in?" And I said, "Whoa."
Oh,
I mean, you know the little thing that hangs down the back of your mouth is like a little stalactite called the uvula?
Like
yeah. And imagine two, roughly deep sort of crater-like reddish holes that had healed. Sort of indented into the roof of the mouth, just behind the hard palate, but just in front of the uvula.
Oh my!
About a quarter of an inch apart, right on the center line of the palate, and about 3/16 of an inch in diameter, and very red, as though there was still some, you know, irritation in the skin. But
wow,
this was an implantation site that had happened almost 15 to 20 years earlier.
Jeepers.
And so, I mean, and this lady had MRIs and X-rays and things to show that these things were two objects that were implanted at the same moment. She had gone through hypnotic regression and had apparently, as a child, was a ballet student. Eventually became a professional dancer. She and her mom were on the way to a recital. It was right about sunset. They were living in Alabama. They came to an intersection, and suddenly all the vehicles in that intersection where they were stopped stalled. All the adults just sort of seemed to pass out. And she said that she looked off to the right towards the sunset and saw a very large Saturn-shaped UFO drifting in over the telephone poles, and it cast a beam of light out the side of the vessel, and it rendered the entire right side of this little Fiat that she and her mom were riding in transparent like glass.
Wow.
And she said there were these three little sort of entities that looked like Casper the Friendly Ghost, except with big black eyes, floating across the field, came over to the vehicle. They reached right through the sheet metal like it was jello, and pulled her right out of her seatbelt, right through the sheet metal of the car, and took her over to the vessel and where they did this implantation. And a lot of the memories for how that was done were recovered in hypnotic regression and,
wow.
and that kind of thing. And it was a rather graphic experience. It was interesting because she described the aliens as wearing what amounted to it looked like transparent burkas with a sort of a broad optically clear band of some kind of material around where the eyes were, and all the rest of the outfit was sort of this very pliable, flexible, completely transparent suit that went from head to floor.
Hmm.
With pockets for the arms and the fingers and that kind of thing. But she said there was a machine that rolled up to the table, extended an arm out over the table. Her head was sort of cradled in a kind of stirrup, and with a band across her forehead and another sort of a bar that held the lower part of her jaw open. And this thing sort of mechanically extended out, had what looked like two large knitting needle-sized syringes that sort of turned around and with her head tilted back. And there was like a BB on the end of each one of these the needles. And they were driven right through the roof of her mouth with no anesthetic at all. And that was, the pain and the shock was what pretty much knocked her out. And the next thing she knows, she and her mom are in the parking lot where the recital's to occur. And the recital's ending. Everybody's coming out and saying, what happened? You know, we were really looking forward to your dance. But that was when it started.
Huh.
And so, as I sat there sort of acting like a police composite sketch artist, drawing, pictures, portraits of the perpetrators, I began taking detailed descriptions from her about what these entities look like, putting together what amounted to a sketch of your stereotypical gray alien. As I'm drawing this and we're refining the image, tears well up in her eyes.
Wow.
She begins to break out in a sweat. Her hands are trembling, and her voice is quivering, and she's starting to cry, and she says, that's just exactly what they look like.
Wow.
And, I've encountered other people who claim this experience, and they're happy, and their arms are moving around, and they're explaining. And they just love the attention, and they want everybody to listen to them.
Mm.
And those are the people who I tend to have my greatest doubts about,
mm-hmm,
because they
mm-hmm.
just, everything's wonderful, and the aliens just love us, and they want to save the planet, and this kind of thing.
Right.
But it's the ones that have the sort of mannerisms of people who've been through kind of a post-traumatic stress type of environment, a situation like that, that I tend to give a lot more credibility to. And I've met a few of them. Interestingly, the ones that have been afforded the greatest degree of freedom to move around the vessels, the ones that have provided me the most detail about how some of these systems might work on board these craft, are the ones who were absolutely and completely compliant with everything that the entities asked them to do.
Ah.
And one of them had probably the most horrific test that you can imagine. She was led naked into a room where there was a man laying on a gurney, also completely naked, and they handed her a big butcher knife and they instructed her to kill this man.
Oh my.
And she refused. And so they said, well, if you don't kill him, then we will kill you. And she still refused. So then they said, well, if you don't do this, then we're going to basically force you, and they can paralyze you, fully conscious, able to stand and everything, but they can basically force you to stand there with your eyes wide open and watch as they go ahead and do it, and that's essentially what happened. And
oh
so, of course, she's completely traumatized by this. And the whole time, it's like they're observing her reactions and all the things that are going on in her head. And so much of what happens with these entities, it all happens through the eyes. But the thing that was so striking about that particular event was that then, almost as if someone waving a wand, suddenly the man is back together, completely intact. I mean, they literally eviscerated this poor man and dismembered him while she was forced to watch. And then suddenly, he's right back the way he was before, completely unscathed.
Wow.
And it was all something that they had put into her mind as kind of a screen memory, I guess you'd call it.
Yeah,
But to see what her reaction would be. And apparently, this is a test that she passed. And from that point on, she was given complete freedom to move about the craft.
Wow.
Because they knew that she would not be a threat. She would not harm anyone, even at the risk of her own life being lost. She would not harm anything or another creature. So, but at one point, they led her from... It was very interesting because they had a kind of alloy that reacted to mental thought patterns. And she could hear what they were thinking. And you know, she would walk up to a wall with one of these entities, and it would think the phrase, "Open door, please." And the wall would literally sort of melt back into a pocket. That was just, so they would open this patch with this doorway.
Wow.
And then as they passed through it, the command was for the door to restore itself, and it would literally flow like that... the T-2000 or whatever it was from the Terminator movies,
the
one that looked like flowing mercury, that's exactly what this thing looked like when the door would close. And they even told her what the ingredients for the alloy was, and she told me, I've written it all down, what the percentages were and everything.
Wow.
The whole question is, how do you manufacture something like that? So,
well, I bet there are corporations that are doing it.
So at one point, they led her into what I guess you might call the engine room.
Uh-huh.
And this is after I had already had some fairly detailed descriptions of what the first rudimentary anti-gravity propulsion system that the Lockheed Corporation had built back in the 1960s in something called the Fluxliner, or it's also known as the Alien Reproduction Vehicle. I know it sounds kind of hokey, but that's what they really called it. But it involved a very large set of coils that sort of surrounded a vertical column at the very center of the ship. The coils looked more like copper tubing rather than a finely braided copper wire. And these copper tubes or coils were embedded in a kind of quartz, clear quartz, optically clear quartz. And that the central column that was sitting sort of down in this almost like a conversation pit that dropped down below the top level of this coil of ring of coils embedded in the quartz, it was also clear, and she could see a fluid that was moving within that. Now, because I've studied so many different types of science, including meteorology and hydrodynamics and things like that, she began describing this fluid, and she said it was kind of a dark, silvery fluid with what looked like some very fine metallic flecks that were swirling around within it. And these flecks, the shimmering quality of this substance, this fluid, looked a little bit like mercury with little particles of pepper sprinkled throughout. But it allowed her to see what the turbulence patterns were within the fluid itself.
Mm.
And what she was seeing, and this column was rotating in one direction. There was a small metal band that projected out several inches near the base, right before it went through the floor. The little metal ring was turning in one direction. The center of this glass or quartz-like column was turning in the opposite direction, so there was sort of a counter-rotating kind of effect going on there. But she said that what she was seeing within this clear glass-like column was what looked like a series of small tornadoes that were spiraling up through the column, almost like a helical kind of a pattern. But there were probably five or six individual tornado-like turbulence patterns.
Mm.
And, you know, if you're familiar with some of the more dramatic tornadoes that we have here in the United States, if you get up to around an F4 and F5, a lot of times you'll have the large, you know, half-mile across huge tornado in the middle, and you'll have all of these what they call sister tornadoes that will be orbiting around the perimeter of the larger one. And it is that exact kind of pattern that she was seeing in the turbulence inside this column, is like those sister tornadoes spiraling up. So essentially what she was looking at was two cylinders, one inside the other, moving in opposite directions. And it's imagine taking your hands, putting a pencil in between them, and moving your hands in opposite directions. So you're creating this sort of a torque or a twisting moment on the pencil. So the pencil sort of spins between your hands as you move them in opposite directions. And that's the same kind of mechanical action that you would have in order to produce this particular kind of turbulence pattern. So, of course, the fluid was moving upward, which begs the question, okay, where is it going? And so it was apparently a closed loop kind of a design.
Mm.
And so when you take everything that was described there, it sounds exactly like some of the details that have been revealed in more recently declassified Nazi scientific papers that described the so-called the Bell Project, the Glocka, I think it was called, up in the Wenceslas mine in Poland, right near the end of the Second World War, that involved a ceramic dome under which there were two counter-rotating cylinders, and in those cylinders was a solution that involved mostly mercury, but also had a radioisotope called thorium and beryllium oxide. Now, in my discussions with a number of my friends in the physics community, the first question I had was, well, why would they put a radioisotope in the solution? What would be the purpose of that? And usually what has been discovered in high-energy types of or systems that are producing tremendous energetic events, extremely powerful electrical discharges, is if you want some other kind of emissions to occur, one of the ways that you can do that is by adding something that's already a little bit unstable to the mix, like thorium. You know, as a radioisotope, of course, it has a little bit of radioactivity, and that can act as a catalyst for kicking loose other kinds of emissions, whether it's X-ray photons or something else, gamma rays, these kinds of things. And so beryllium oxide, one source told me that it actually was performing as a kind of wetting agent, something that would keep the mercury in complete contact with the electrodes, even during these powerful electrical discharges, so that you wouldn't get cavitating and pitting mm-hmm. of the electrodes when these tremendous bursts of electricity came off these electrodes. Now, from the different sources that I've had the opportunity to talk to about this device, which I guess you would qualify as a kind of a free energy device, there were the coils, of course, that in the typical flying saucer would be the coils that would be wrapped around the belt line of the crew compartment, the central column in the middle, which has these two counter-rotating spheres and the mercury-type solution. But one of the things that was also described was a coil that wrapped up inside the interior of the inner cylinder. In other words, if you have two cylinders that are concentric, one inside the other, this other coil would be wrapped up on the inside of the innermost column or cylinder. And this particular coil was kind of unusual in that it looked like a very long, spindly bottle brush, something that had all these little whiskers that would stick out into the solution. but it hugged the inner wall of that inner cylinder. And so if you look at, you know, Mercury passing upward in that gap between the two counter-rotating cylinders, you of course, get that shearing type of motion that will give you these little tornado-like vortices that climb in a spiral fashion up to the top. And then the Mercury basically flows down through a venturi at the top, mm-hmm. sort of a cone-shaped electrode in the middle, and the other part of this venturi is like a little funnel that wraps around it with a gap in between for the Mercury to pass in between. And then right at the base of that funnel is a sort of an annular or a ring-shaped electrode. And the electrical discharge would jump between these two objects. And at that same moment, you're probably familiar with there's a fitting that you can put on your shower. It's called a shower massage, where it pulses the water.
Oh, sure, I have
a massage. Okay. Well, imagine a similar type of mechanism in at the very top of this venturi, so that the flow of the mercury basically is kind of pulsing, right?
Okay.
And so the pulsing is timed to match the electrical discharge that goes between that cone-shaped electrode and the one that's shaped like a ring. And so as you get just beyond the bottom end of this funnel-shaped venturi, the inner chamber for that inner cylinder opens out into a kind of almost imagine that the shape of the inner cylinder is kind of like the top end of those ancient urns that they find in these marine archaeological projects. They're called amphoras. I think you've probably seen them. Sort of a ceramic clay thing that the Greeks would transport wine and other types of goods across the ocean. And they have a couple of handles, and then there's a cone-shaped opening at the top. They put a cork in, and then there's a pair of shoulders that kind of come out, and then it tapers down to a point at the bottom. Imagine that the inner cylinder has an inner core or shape that's like that, that this bottle brush electrode wraps up inside of. But when that electrical discharge occurs, timed to correspond with the pulse in the flow of the mercury coming out of that venturi, basically what happens is you wind up with a shearing effect that's kind of like what happens when a cigar smoker blows a smoke ring.
Uh-huh.
Okay? So really it's just a matter of shaping your lips in just the right way as you spit out a puff of smoke, and it becomes a sort of like a self-organizing, self-stabilizing and shearing moment that occurs in the air. You have the ambient air just outside of your face, and then you send this little puff of smoke out, and you have the gases coming from your lips that are moving very quickly in the center, and it basically pulls the smoke out to the edges, and you have this sort of precessing of the smoke around the edges. But it becomes a very, I mean, if you've ever seen a smoke ring when they're actually blown by someone who has that particular skill, you'll see that the smoke is swirling in towards the center and then out to the edge and in towards the center and out towards the edge. And so there's a kind of precessing in the particles of smoke. Well, this is the same thing that happens at the moment of this electrical discharge in this power system. And so
what does all this stuff do?
Well, have you ever heard of the term ball lightning?
No.
Well, ball lightning is a natural effect. It's a natural, a natural phenomenon that occurs when you have lightning striking rock where there appears to be a high, or I should say a great number of quartz deposits. This is sort of an observation from things that have happened. You see this a lot in the United States. You see a lot around the Rocky Mountains. But they've been able to recreate this particular kind of phenomena in the laboratory, and they've done it with this exact same kind of a electrical discharge orifice, kind of shaped like a venturi, that they expel some gases through at the moment that you have this electrical discharge. Now, there's one scientist that I'm acquainted with. His name is James Woodward, who had done quite a bit of experimentation with this. And what he didn't know at the time when he started this was that these energetic events are so powerful that they actually create X-ray photons, which can be quite lethal. Mm. And so he spent quite a bit of time fighting cancer after his research began progressing. He didn't, you know, take into account that this might be one of the side effects. But, of course, X-ray photons are highly energetic and, you know, under the right circumstances can be used as a source of energy. And so this may, in fact, be sort of what's happening with this sort of bottle brush type electrode on the inside is it's creating a type of emission with the help of the thorium being present that is being collected on that bottle brush type electrode, because what you're creating is artificial ball lightning, in essence. You get a toroid or a donut-shaped phenomenon that shoots down through that inner cylinder. The cylinder, of course, is rotating around its vertical axis, but at the same time, you have the shearing effect of that pulse, the, you know, the sort of the shower massage type pulsing that's occurring in the liquid itself. And then you combine that with the high energetic discharge of electricity between the cone-shaped electrode and the one that's shaped like a ring.
Okay. Now, are you describing then the energy system of the ship?
Yes, exactly.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Well, I don't think we need to have... I don't mean to interrupt you, but we don't need to have all the technical details because nobody's going to be building this.
Well, I'm kind of a nuts and bolts guy.
We've only got 15 minutes left, and I think people are really interested in this topic, and a couple of questions came up for me.
Okay.
And one was, if this particular entity, the Greys, or, you know, whatever they are controlling the matter with thought, then that would imply that they have instantaneous manifestation abilities over matter. And so that kind of blows Einstein's public theories out of the water, and it allows for us to develop ideas that there is much faster than light possibilities, that the fastest thing is not light, and that that's a misconception that we've been given and hold on to, because the agencies like NASA and the other scientific agencies continue to put out that information, and it seems like we're stuck in kind of a time warp, literally, and that our, you know, we may be as mind controlled as the woman that you talked to that was shown these images. I mean, everything here on Earth could be a projection like that.
Yeah, so, something like you know, the story, sort of the subtext or the story behind the Matrix series of movies.
Oh yeah.
And in fact, one of the things that she discovered, there was an occasion when she was sort of kidnapped from her home in a kind of military abduction. One of these young ladies that I interviewed, and she was so upset by what had happened that she refused to make eye contact with the entities that were in the room, and she, to her great amazement, discovered that these entities have absolutely no control over you if you don't make direct eye contact with them. And one of the other things we found was that this link that they seem to be able to make with your consciousness, with your mind, is all done through the eyes. And in fact, one of the ways in which you can block that is by wearing mirrored sunglasses, which, if you recall, was what all of those exchange suits were wearing at the end of the movie called Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Oh, yeah.
They're all wearing.
Yeah, and you know, did you see the movie They Live?
Yes.
By Carpenter?
Yes, absolutely. Great movie.
Of course, that's a different kind of sunglass.
Yes, that's right. That's true. But apparently, there are people that I've known who do have a limited ability in this area. And many of them, there are a number of people who do have this ability. They can do what I call a consciousness insertion. They can get inside your head. They can tell you what's wrong with you, what your health problems are, what you're thinking. And some of them have such a powerful ability that they can heal at a distance by having just a photograph of your eyes, because they can see the frequency of your consciousness in a good, clear photograph of your eyes. But these gamblers, they all wear the mirrored sunglasses when they're at the poker table playing these big championship competitions, because that's how they're able to get inside the head of their opponent across the table and know what cards they're holding.
Well, it's interesting.
Yeah.
They say that the eyes are the window to the soul.
That's absolutely right, yes.
And
I couldn't have said it better. Yeah.
That many of the abductions, as you probably found out, some of them are quite legitimate. And
yes.
That the person experiences a trauma-based reaction to it, but that Dr. Stephen Greer mentions that most of the abductions, or a lot of them, have been done by military. And if you type up my labs in the search engine,
yes,
you'll get the military version of the abductions, because they're involved in mimicking for their own purposes abductions and implanting the thought that, you know, you were abducted by aliens.
Yeah.
So,
well, I know some of the people that have had that experience, and it can be every bit as traumatizing.
Oh, yeah,
as,
if not
as
worse.
The run-of-the-mill alien abduction, as funny as that may sound.
Yeah.
But, you know, the key seems to be tapping into the consciousness through the eyes. Now, you know, I was so intrigued by the phenomenon once I convinced myself that this really was going on, that people really were having these kinds of experiences. I cultivated a friendship with someone who was having this kind of experience on a monthly basis, got an invitation to spend the night with her and a roommate when they anticipated one of these contacts. And the way that she knew was that she had implants that were behind her eardrums. You can actually see them because the eardrum's almost transparent under the right conditions. And these things would go off and you know, create nausea and dizziness, but that was kind of their way of letting her know they were going to be there within 24 hours. So we set it up so I'd go over, spent the whole night waiting for them to show up, and then in the morning, right before the sun came up, is when they decided to arrive. Sort of the cue or the clue that you know, they had decided to make an appearance was that all the dogs in the neighborhood began howling emphatically. Not like dogs howling at a passing emergency vehicle with a siren running, but like dogs that have been hit by a car or something. I mean, very painfully. And lasted for exactly 90 seconds, and then from that moment on, even though I was wide awake, I was completely paralyzed and could not move.
Wow.
And sort of devised a means. I mean, I was involved in athletics when I was a young man, and, you know, my coach said, you know, if you ever get hit really hard, you know, if you can still wiggle your toes, then you know that you're not really paralyzed. And so my thought was, well, I can wiggle my toes, so there must be some way to get out of whatever this is. And as I began trying to implement that solution, I was suddenly rendered completely unconscious. I heard a sort of a popping sound in the middle of my head. And then, you know, I was out for about a minute, woke up again, but could not move and could not even conceive of a method by which I could get out of it. But it was like that for an hour. According to my watch, which I could see on my wrist from where I was, the time proceeded normally. But when this phenomenon finally ended, again with another 90 seconds of all the dogs howling, it turned out that we'd lost a complete hour of time. And then instead of being 8 a.m. in the morning, it was now 9 a.m. Now, the interesting thing was that later, as some of this young lady had an unusually strong ability to be able to remember within a day or so what had actually happened during her encounters. And she described what amounted to a wormhole opening up in her bedroom, a couple of the gray entities walking into her room demanding telepathically that she come over and face them. And then, and this is in December of 1989, this was all written down, this encounter, but she described 9/11. She described seeing two big buildings in a metropolitan area first appearing to catch on fire and then collapsing one after the other. She was then shown a tremendous earthquake on the sea floor and this incredible tsunami passing across the ocean and killing hundreds of thousands of people. Then she was shown another earthquake on the seafloor off the coast of Japan and another tremendous cataclysm happening. Those three events have already happened, as you well know. There was the earthquake in Banda Aceh, Indonesia, in 2004, December, I think it was the 26th. Of course, there was 9/11, 2001, with the World Trade Center collapse.
Right.
Then the Fukushima earthquake. But then she was shown a fourth cataclysmic event, and she was told that there would be a mass landing in the high desert of California after this fourth event, and it hasn't happened yet. But she said that event would be an earthquake just like the previous two. If you know, Banda Aceh and Fukushima were both 9.0. She said the third earthquake, the fourth event, would be a 9.0 earthquake with an epicenter near the Salton Sea in Southern California, which is sort of between San Diego and Palm Springs. And that it would set off a chain reaction of quakes. It would ripple up the San Andreas fault system, and that it would level San Diego, Los Angeles, and San Francisco over the course of several hours or a day or two, and that it'll be the greatest single loss of human life to a natural disaster in human history, and that there will be this mass landing shortly after that event takes place. But,
wow.
So this is something, and I have a sense that it's going to happen fairly soon.
Well, yes, and you know, I was born on the San Andreas Fault,
really?
And ironically, I was born in Santa Barbara, and it's on San Andreas Street. And I remember one of the earthquakes, and it felt like the floor was literally made out of water. And as a kid, it was just fascinating. I wasn't scared, but I have a funny feeling that all of the people, the futurists like Lori Toy and the military, have drawn maps which are future projections of what the coastlines will be and the countryside will be after that particular event, which has not happened yet.
Yeah.
And fortunately, or unfortunately, I'm somewhere right at the edge of California where it would be. I'd have beachfront property if we make it that far. I'm about 2,000 feet, and I have had dreams about tidal waves coming over Jerusalem, but over Egypt, where the pyramids are, and Los Angeles.
Wow.
And the tidal wave washes away the sand around the pyramids, and there are some amazing things under there that we haven't seen and probably don't know about.
Mm-hmm. I've heard as much myself. You know.
Yes, yes. You know... it's really getting exciting because I would love to keep talking about this, and we've got like 1 minute left before we have to sign off.
Well, we'll just have to talk really fast.
Well, you know, we could also schedule something again, and we'll have another chat, fireside chat, and let's just delve into this subject and just get right into it.
Well, I'd enjoy that very much, yeah.
I mean, because it's a lot of fun, and you're great to talk to, and you know a lot. So, and this is the kind of conversation I like to have, and I know that the listeners love it. So,
the underlying point of what I was telling you was
it just
establishes that time travel is possible because she showed all these things as though these entities had already witnessed these events, and they were simply transferring the images. I mean, she basically saw the collapse of the World Trade Center as though she was in an aircraft from above watching it as it happened.
Yes.
So it basically authenticates that time travel is possible just because these events that were described in 1989 have already happened.
Absolutely. I am so with you on that one. And we could get into how the future sends documents back to the past and, you know, CERN and the time travel and what they're doing. This could be a really fun show to continue on. So let's remember where we left off at time travel. And we'll do this again soon, and we'll pick up where we left off.
Great. I'd love
and
it.
If you have any websites that you want to mention again before we go, please feel free to. And I just want to thank you for being on the show.
Well, I appreciate the invitation very much. I always love talking to the audience in the UK. I just have some friends over there. And yes, you can probably find more images of my work on my Facebook page, which is really just Mark McCandlish at Facebook. My website, which does seem to need a little bit of work, is www.markmccandlish.com.
And your artwork is beautiful, by the way.
Thank you.
I'd love to see you do something futuristic that comes from the imagination from what we've talked about.
Well, you know, I have some things that along those lines that are being worked on right now. I don't know if you know who David Adair is and his sort of adventure out at Area 51 when he was a little kid. He designed a nuclear-powered rocket that turned out to be kind of a replica of something that was found or captured and being held at Area 51.
And that's a wonderful story. Mark that spot, and we will come back and have a conversation about that and time travel and the other fun stuff that we can talk about. We really need to sign off and so that the next show can start live on time. So thank you, Mark.
Hi.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Yeah, good night, everybody.